supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we have a very interesting show for you today, cats and kittens. In the question of the week, we will discuss whether you can keep flea beetles off of your eggplant with a spray of clay. But before that, and intermingled with your fabulous phone calls, you'll also hear me being interviewed for a change about the wickedly warm winter we've been experiencing and what that does to our poor plants. That's all coming up after some of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Judy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there. I'm in State College, and I heard your show last week, and you talked about various watering regimes using soaking hoses and so forth. I have a garden plot where I put a lot of tomato plants in the later on in the year, and unfortunately, we don't have water access except to a faucet, and we have to lug buckets of water to our plots. So I was wondering, in that scenario, what you recommend in terms of a watering schedule.
So are you in a community garden, or the garden is just situated far away from your house?
It's a community garden.
And they don't have water?
Well, they have water. They have two faucets, but you have to get a wagon and buckets and wheel it to your plot.
How big a spot do you have?
Probably room for 3 dozen tomato plants. Oh,
that's
pretty big. Other things.
That's pretty big. In your situation, you sound like a great candidate for a rain barrel. A State College, where I will be appearing on.
I know. I have tickets.
You have tickets. You come into the dinner or the daytime show?
Both.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. April 7th and 8th. I can't wait. Very good. Oh, I'll answer your question in person then. Click. No. So I think you're a great candidate for a rain barrel because, you know, you live in an area with a good amount of rain and winter snow. And, you know, if you buy these things pre-made, they're like $100. But there are also workshops where you can make your own, and where you're based in State College, that is the Pennsylvania official agricultural university. So they have a tremendous extension system. And I bet you they do rain barrel workshops where you can get a discounted professionally made rain barrel. And, you know, you wouldn't even have to wait for the rain because here's what we're going to do. You're going to put your rain barrel in place and you're going to avoid the biggest rookie mistake. You're going to put it up on a base. So it's like a foot off the ground. So gravity works for you.
Right.
And then you get some helpers, you get a nice day, whatever. You haul the water and you fill up the rain barrel and make sure you have mosquito screening on top. Most of the professional made ones come with the screening that fits tightly on the lid. And then you'll have a little faucet at the bottom. You attach your drip lines to that. Then when you have gone a week without rain, turn it on and try to figure out, you know, what equals an inch of water. I mean, if maybe there's a scientist who can calculate the volume of the rain barrel and then the square footage of your garden and, you know, figure out how much water would cover it an inch deep. But there's a lot of wiggle room here. Your plants will tell you how they're doing. But basically, using a drip system early in the morning is the most efficient use of water, hands down. It's all going to the root zone. Nothing is getting lost to evaporation. The plants are at their thirstiest and most receptive first thing in the morning. So you can use even less water with this kind of a drip system. And then, of course, you also want to have a mulch on top of the drip irrigation lines to keep the moisture in the soil after you water it. But I think a one-time investment would be a real boon to you. You'd look like the best gardener in the community garden. Talk about showing off. Oh, she's got a rain barrel. And, you know, after the first year, you probably wouldn't have to haul water to it. It would probably fill up naturally during thunderstorms.
Uh-huh. Yeah, well, that's a thought. Some of the rows where I put the tomatoes have that plastic fabric that keeps down weeds, and it's porous, so water goes through it, but I guess that'll just help.
I personally don't care for the weed fabric. Grassy weeds love to grow up through it. But if you're having good luck with it, yes, as you say, it's porous. It's designed to let rainwater through. So
Right. Your
drip water will be going even more slowly. A thunderstorm water might just bounce off of that. But the drip water will go in nice. All right?
Okay. Thank you, Mike. See you soon.
Yes, I will see you and all of our other friends in State College on April 7th and 8th. I can't wait.
Yes, well, we can't wait either. And for spring also.
Yes, I'll bring it with me. I'll pack it.
Okay, great.
Take care,
Jimmy. All
right,
thank you.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Jennifer, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for answering my call. I'm in Coatesville, Pennsylvania.
All right. Jennifer knows the drill. What can we do for Jennifer in Coatesville?
Well, I've been listening to your show for a long time, and we've changed our seed starting process because of the information we've gotten from you.
Good.
So instead of a windowsill and a yogurt cup, we've moved on to the unfinished part of the basement with bright lights.
Right.
And compost that we get from our CSA. And everything looks really, really good, except the zinnia seedlings. When they have their first two leaves come up, some, but not all, the leaves curl a little bit. And then right at the base of the stem, it starts to wilt, and then they just topple over and shrivel and die.
Okay. Now, you're starting in pure compost. I never recommended that, dear. I recommend that you go out to an independent garden center and get a bag of soil-free mix. It might be called seed starting mix. It might be called professional mix. It might be called potting soil. But essentially, you want something that's a combination of peat, perlite, vermiculite, and a little bit of compost for nutrition.
Now, okay, so I'm giving them too much nutrition.
Yeah, it doesn't drain well enough. Plants need air around their roots, especially young plants starts. How long have you had your plants growing?
I think about 3 weeks now.
So you jumped the gun. I mean,
I really did. I got excited.
Okay, well, that's good. That's good. It's an exciting time, but it also means that you have time to start over. Now,
yes.
I'm glad you got the bright lights. What did you replace the yogurt cups with?
Oh, I have the seed starting packs that you can get at the store. They're come in little squares.
Okay.
Big, long rectangle. I don't know what they're really called.
No, that's fine. That's fine. So they have good drainage on the bottom.
Yes.
And do you have something underneath to catch excess water?
They come with a tray that comes underneath it, so that catches it.
Oh, okay. So I think what's happening to your zinnias, which may be more prone to this than some of the other plants, but it's going to catch up with all of them, is called damping off. That's when the plants can't drain. It's so important to keep the soil saturated while the seed is germinating. But once the plant is up, you want to make sure that it dries out between waterings.
Oh, okay. I'm definitely not doing that. Okay.
Yeah, that tray may be your single biggest problem.
Okay.
So the first thing is just move the tray out of the way. Just take that tray and empty it into a little bucket for next time or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you literally want air to get down at those drainage holes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that is definitely not happening right now, so I can fix that.
Yeah, and that's a rookie mistake that a lot of people make. Nobody is good at seed starting for the first 3 or 4 years. It's a totally different skill set than outdoor gardening. But if you kill a bunch of plants and you learn from your mistakes, after 5 or 6 years, you don't even think about it anymore. You just run through the motions and people think you're a genius.
Oh, great.
Now, what
kind of wait for that to happen?
What kind of light?
They're fluorescent lights, the long tube lights.
Good. How close are the tops of the plants to the bottom of the lights?
The lights are probably 18 inches to 2 feet away.
Oh God, no! If the lights can't be lowered, you want to raise up the plants.
Even closer.
Oh, an inch.
What? Okay. Yeah.
When you hold a light meter right up an inch away from 4-foot-long fluorescent tubes, you get a nice reading. Take it down to 2 inches, and the light intensity may drop by half. By the time you're down to 18 inches, you're back in your so-called sunny window. I absolutely can tell you your plants are too tall and leggy.
They're a little leggy.
Yeah,
they are.
Yeah, yeah. So you got plenty of time. It's better to start a little bit later, so then you're not rushing the plants out into cold soil. I would get a good bag of seed starting mix, get some way of getting the plants up close to the lights, and that's why a lot of times these kits, the lights are on chains, so you can raise or lower them.
Okay.
But that combination of letting them drain after the plants are all sprouted and keeping them close to the light, you're going to have great-looking starts this season.
Oh, great.
All right?
That is great. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Good timing. Good luck.
All right, thanks. Have a good one. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that the last days of the fabulous Philadelphia Flower Show are upon us. This year's show closes on Sunday the 19th. That means you still have a little bit of time to visit Holland at the Pennsylvania Convention Center in downtown Philly. But don't go looking for all the details at theflowershow.com just yet, because we'll be right back to beat the Beatles, hear me interviewed about wickedly warm winters, and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hardworking hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, we will conquer flea beetles and take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it is time for me to swap chairs and be the interviewee, as my good friend Dave Heller, who hosts Newsworks Tonight every weekday evening here on WHYY, home of the stars, interviews me about the wickedly warm winter we're experiencing and the potentially disastrous effects it could have on plant life and wildlife.
Mike, it's springtime.
In February.
Is that a good thing?
No, it really isn't, Dave. I mean, I am as guilty as anybody else. This past weekend, when we had those just insanely warm temperatures, my wife and I were out on our balcony getting sun on the back of our necks, just watching the woods, and it was glorious. But in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about last year, which was the warmest winter in recorded history. And what happened at the end of that winter is, as you can probably remember, you certainly remember if you're a gardener with flowering trees, at the very end of that winter, we had a hammering cold front come down from the Arctic, drop the temperature in the burbs down into the teens and the 20s, and it didn't qualify as a, quote, late frost. We had been inside the realm of you are still at great risk of frost, and it was still going to be great risk of frost for another couple of weeks. The problem was the plants were following the temperature. They were blooming weeks early. And so entire peach crops, entire apple crops, ornamental flowering trees like flowering cherries, once the flowers freeze, it's over.
What happens in turn to bees and other insects that are part of the process as well?
That's a really good question, because if those flowers die on one of the first couple of days, you know, we tend to think of it in the other direction. Oh, the bees will come in and they will help us have more magnificent fruits, or even in ornamental plants, a better display of flowers. But what happens from the bee side is, hey, when did this diner close? Nobody told me. So where they would have a couple of weeks of nectar and pollen from these huge plants that are very important to their survival, because especially early in the spring, we're mostly talking native bees. We're mostly talking about all the bees that occur naturally in this area and around the country. There's not a lot else in bloom at that time of the year.
Now let's talk about something good. Nature is resilient. There will be a process going forward.
Yeah, you're seeing the process with more and more so-called invasive plants taking over. Plants like porcelain berry, which is absolutely beautiful. It sounds exactly the way it looks like. It's this incredible vine with beautiful flowers and fruits that look like tiny little miniature gems of some kind. But it grows like 20 feet a year. It just wipes out other plants. The warmer the climate, the warmer the winter. And nobody's really sure why this is, but we're pretty sure it's actually happening. The more it favors vining plants, wild grape, this porcelain vine, kudzu down south, even our own native poison ivy, the warm weather just gives them such a head start, whereby things like apples, peach trees, raspberries, these come from other parts of the world, and they really depend on a cold winter.
Now, is it that these invasive species are better acclimated to warmer temperatures, or can they also better withstand this temporary taste of spring and then back into a freeze?
They are really tough plants. They are the survivors right now. Now, I know a lot of people get nuts about these plants and go out into the wild and herbicide the heck out of them.
Oh, no, I love poison ivy.
But the truth is that this is probably constant. Nature is not a Disney movie. Nature is a Darwin theory. The types of plants that will survive in an environment without human intervention are going to constantly be in a state of change, not a state of stasis. So we're seeing this. But a lot of the plants that we've come to know and love, and especially if you're an orchardist, if you've got a couple of hundred peach trees or a couple of hundred apple trees, your methods of keeping the flowers in place are very limited. Back in the old days, believe it or not, they would dig trenches in the orchards, fill the trenches with diesel fuel, and light the diesel fuel on fire on the worst nights. Now, of course, that was just environmentally criminal. And it's no longer allowed. But this is the kind of situation, especially 2 years in a row, Dave. If this happens again, if we have a 20-degree night again when these fruit trees are in blossom, many of these people will literally lose the farm.
Now, you don't have a farm, but for the cohort of home gardeners, yourself included, You don't want to just sit still. What can be done?
Well, hopefully you have trees that are manageable, dwarf-sized trees or semi-dwarf trees. If you have a standard apple tree, for instance, that thing's going to be 30 feet tall. You're limited in what you can do. But if you have a manageable tree that you've kept pruned that's like 6 or 8 feet tall, one of the best things you can do is cover it with Remay. Now, that's a brand name, but it's what people talk about when they talk about a floating row cover. You've seen these pictures of the lettuce fields in California where there's blankets over the crops. Well, those are a polyethylene or polypropylene woven material, sometimes cotton woven material, and they sit on top of the plants, and the frost collects on top of the row cover and doesn't affect the flowers as much. And if the row cover goes on earlier in the day, it can trap some heat. But actually, what I do with a peach tree that's right outside our front door is the Goyesha Christmas light trick. I still have all the old Christmas lights from my parents' house, the old C7, C9s, the little incandescent lights that get really hot.
Back when the electric bill was pretty cheap.
Oh, it wasn't cheap then. I mean, Christmas, you saw that real peak go up, especially if you were one of those houses they could see from space. But you get a couple strings of these old incandescent Christmas lights, which you can still find at yard sales and in people's attics, and you run an extension cord and then string them around the branches as much as you can. And then as soon as the temperature starts to drop down, you turn them on. And you don't care about time of day or anything like that. You leave the lights on. And that has proven to be 100% effective. Last year, I walked a gas grill out under another tree and, you know, turned it on low and closed the lid overnight. That tree didn't make it. The blossoms froze. But the Goyesha Christmas light tree, we got a lot of good fruit off of that tree.
Here's your chance to pick your poison. Would you rather we stay with springtime now moving forward, or do you want to see another frost ahead?
If we just go forward, everything will be early. Everything may be quicker, like the cherry blossoms show across the Potomac. The higher the temperature, the less amount of time those flowers will stay. The higher the temperature, the faster the show will be over. The cooler the temperature without freezing, the longer the show will go. And we're talking a difference of if there's 90-degree days, those trees will be stressed and the flowers will drop after 5 or 6 days, whereby if it's just beautiful weather, 30s at night and 50s during the day, those flowers could be up there for 3 weeks.
Either way, you can promise me a robust poison ivy crop for 2017?
The biggest you've ever seen. And it's a native plant, Native American plant, grown deliberately by Washington and Jefferson in their ornamental gardens. If you want to identify the poison ivy in your landscape conclusively, look at it in the fall. It has blazing red color, just fabulous fall color, as good or better than blueberries or the colors of maple trees. And it forms beautiful red berries, which we rarely get to see because birds eat them. Then they sit on a fence somewhere and they poop out those seeds, and that's where the next run of poison ivy comes from.
Didn't know they had calamine lotion back in the days of our founding fathers.
You know, I often think about that because the stories are them just tending this plant like any other. And you got to think, I mean, the streets must have smelled so awful and people smelled so awful and everybody was dirty. You couldn't, like, be fastidious back then. You couldn't be taking a shower. That didn't exist. You really washing your hands was probably a real treat. So I think people just didn't notice that there was another rash on top of the other rashes, or just by the fact that they live so close to this natural world, to, you know, quite honestly, in filth, I don't think they were as affected by it as we are in our pristine world, where the first exposure to something is massive compared to back in the old days.
That's why we're more irrational now.
Yeah, that's right.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, Dave, my pleasure. And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Craig, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks, Mike. We're up here in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and we're really having a problem with stink bugs just eating up our tomatoes and peppers.
Okay.
We tried, you know, pretty much doing the usual things. We have alyssum planted around there, and we're also going to be planting dill and fennel attract insects that prey on them. But, you know, we just don't like tomatoes that have little holes eaten in them.
Okay, so stink bugs are kind of like sap suckers. And the damage they cause on tomatoes is they walk over the tomatoes, they discolor them, and then the tomato gets this, like, white ring under the skin, and it makes it tough. If you have any kind of actual pieces missing from your tomatoes, that would be a different pest. That would be birds or slugs or something.
These are, like, it's almost like they've come up and taken a little tiny bite or made a puncture.
Okay. So I think you may see stink bugs and you may have stink bugs, but I don't think the stink bugs are your problem unless the punctures are very small. I mean, very common in a wet year, a wet environment, for slugs to climb up the plants at night. And then they'll eat a little piece off a tomato and then they'll drop back down and hide. Birds are notorious, some birds, I think like catbirds, for coming into the garden and perching on the tomato cages and making little holes in the tomatoes with their beaks, either theoretically to get moisture or probably just to annoy you.
My wife is reminding me that the spots are like little yellow or whitish spongy bits.
Okay, so that could be, and obviously you're seeing a lot of stink bugs all over the plants.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so growing in raised beds or flat earth?
It's all raised beds.
Good, 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 good. And what do you feed?
What do we feed?
Yes, what food do you use? The questions get much tougher after this.
Well, we've used homemade compost as well as, you know, some pre-bagged.
Okay, so you
beef compost, that sort of thing.
Okay, good, good. All right, so here's your options. I would suggest that you go out in the morning with a little handheld vacuum. Either maybe you can run an Electrolux, a canister vacuum or something out there, or go out and buy one of those dustbuster things. Vacuum a bunch of the bugs off the plants first thing in the morning to help keep their numbers down. And then I'm going to suggest an old remedy I haven't talked about on the show for years and years, but I think you're ripe for it if you're planting like little flowers around to attract beneficial insects. How would you like to make some bug juice?
Sure.
So you collect the stink bugs in the morning. You can either, you know, if they're all over the plants, you can knock them into a bucket with a little bit of soapy water in the bottom, or you can vacuum them up. And then you get an old garage sale blender, you know, something you're not going to use to make margaritas with.
Okay, and I know where you're headed with this.
Yeah, and you put in a pint of water or some of the soapy water and one drop of oil, like vegetable oil. And if you didn't have the soapy water, a couple of drops of dishwashing soap. And then you whiz them up until they are a stink bug smoothie. And then you go out early in the morning and you spray this mixture directly on the plants. There is a theory, and this was originally for Japanese beetles, another tough pest. There is a theory that the dead bugs, the smell of the dead stink bugs, which is going to be quite a smell. I mean, they're stink bugs, will actually repel more stink bugs from coming in. Alternately,
you know, I've also read something that, you know, squashing a stink bug attracts more stink bugs.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think in nature you run towards an area where you just saw your best friend get squished. But your other alternative would be to go out with a professionally made light horticultural oil or an insecticidal soap. And again, early in the morning, spray either one of these materials directly on the insect, not on the plants, but just soak the insect with either a light summer oil spray or an insecticidal soap spray, and that'll smother them.
Okay. We've heard about something made by Safer called Endol.
Well, that sounds dramatic.
I know. And they also make a stink bug trap.
Oh, yes.
Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, the stink bug traps are good for indoors. They're not good for outdoors.
Gotcha.
The damage is mostly done by young stink bugs who are actually walking on the plants that aren't flying to the trap. Safer, generally, I mean, at least in the, I haven't seen Safer products in a long time, but they have traditionally been natural and organic. I'm not sure what's in it, but to be safe about bees, your smartest thing is to spray the actual insects with oil or soap to smother them.
Right.
Or
right.
Use some bug juice.
I have one last question. Would using diatomaceous earth have any effect on the stink bugs? I don't know if they hide in the ground or if they just...
Diatomaceous earth, which is ground up diatoms, the ancient remains of prehistoric seagoing creatures, that's very effective against slugs and other soft bodied pests. It's not going to have an effect on a stink bug that's essentially an armored foe.
Gotcha.
All right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, sir.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Master Gardener Spring Symposium in Fayetteville, North Carolina on Saturday, March 25th, and in beautiful State College, PA, to host a dinner event on Friday evening, April 7th, and then a talk at the State Theater on Saturday morning, April 8th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back to beat the Beatles and take more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And by Burpee, celebrating their 140th year of providing treasured heirloom varieties, hard-working hybrids, seed starting, garden supplies, and more. Burpee offers no treated seed or genetically modified organisms. Information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we will attack flea beetles with oil and clay. We'll pour burning oil on them as they attempt to hop onto our fortress of eggplants. After a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Eric, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Happy to be here. I'm calling to you from State College. Looking forward to your visit in a week or so.
Yes. April 7th and 8th, I'll be hosting a dinner on that Friday night, and I'll be doing a morning show at the State Theater. I can't wait.
Great. The reason I called is about 20 years ago, my better half made me put in a couple raised beds in our alley.
That's why she's better. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, well, we first dug a deep hole and put the boards around, and we dug up lots of ashes, broken dishes, and car parts.
Oh, man. And did you garden in that?
That's why we did a raised bed, is because the soil was so bad. We put some topsoil back in and then filled it with burrow leaf compost. And then since then, we've been adding kitchen compost, some topsoil, and lots of chopped leaves.
Okay. Now, one thing I want to tell you before we go any further. Once you discovered the debris down there, especially the car parts, you should have just stopped digging in that dirt, washed your hands real well, and filled up that area, and then built the raised beds over top of it with a layer of cardboard in between. The car parts indicate to me that there could have been a lot of lead in that soil.
I'll do that next time.
If that soil is mixed and it's anywhere near the surface, I'd like you to get a lead test. You know, you're in State College, Penn State. That's where the Agricultural Soil Lab is. They can test your soil for lead very quickly.
I will do that.
Okay, now.
Anyhow, the problem is that over the last 20 years, this soil drains very well.
That's not a problem, man. That's a benefit.
And it just doesn't retain moisture.
But that's great. You have no idea, or maybe you do if you used to garden in clay, how terrible the other way is. Keep adding organic matter. Keep adding real good compost. Not leaves themselves. Not shredded leaves, not whole leaves, and especially don't mix any actual leaf you can see into the soil. But add compost to the soil, and if you have shredded leaves, use those as a mulch on top. Mixing organic matter, especially in the form of compost, into soil that drains fast, which is typically we're talking about sandy soil, improves the water holding capacity of that area. And then what you want to do is you want to make sure there's always an organic mulch on the surface of the soil to keep the moisture in the soil. Because obviously, you know, you can lose moisture two ways. It can drain away and it can evaporate away on top. So when you water, water deeply and make sure the organic matter is mixed into the top layer of soil. But then save tons of shredded leaves in the fall and use those to make a good 2-inch mulch on the surface of the soil. That's going to be your best method of keeping lots of moisture in the soil.
We were thinking of adding perlite or vermiculite or biochar or something like that.
Oh, biochar. I haven't heard about that for a while. Is that back in the news?
I don't know, but I've heard things about it. But not lately.
Yeah, no, I haven't heard. That seems to have been a rocket that shot and fatted out. No, actually, just the opposite. Perlite and vermiculite improve the drainage. So if your soil is already drying out too quickly, adding perlite or vermiculite would make it dry out even faster. What you want, and certainly I would never advise anybody to add clay to their garden, but real high-quality compost will give structure to the soil. It'll still drain well, but not as rapidly. The two natural substances, the mined minerals you mentioned, vermiculite and perlite, they're great for people with poor drainage. But you have the opposite. So your cure is 100% organic matter. It's compost on the top inch of the soil mixed in, and then it's 2 inches of shredded leaves on top of the surface to keep that moisture in place.
So about an inch of compost.
The idea, once you build a raised bed to keep the soil healthy, is to add 2 inches of compost a year, preferably to the top, because you don't want to be tilling up raised beds. That's why you built the raised beds, so you wouldn't have to till them again. And then 2 inches of shredded leaves that you can easily save from the fall on top of that 2 inches of compost, and you shouldn't have any negative issues about your soil drying out after that.
Okay. Thank you so much, sir.
All right. Good luck. I'll see you soon.
Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Carol, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Carol. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm about 50 miles north of Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Okay, very good. You've had some crazy weather, haven't you?
Oh, we're dreading summer.
All right. What can we do for Carol in Oklahoma?
I just bought some small spruce seedlings, little things, that allege that they are drought resistant.
Good, good.
It's called a Black Hill spruce. The variety name is Densata.
Okay.
I guess that means it's thick. I know it's slow growing.
Good.
Allegedly, this is a quote, noted for its hardiness and tolerance to wind, heat, cold, and drought.
That's Oklahoma.
Yeah, I think I might be an old Catholic again.
No. It sounds like a very good choice for your location. So how small or large are these saplings?
Well, they're 6 to 12-inch seedlings, so I imagine they're probably 5 inches through your size.
Okay. So are you planning to put them in the spring, or are you going to try to nurture them through their first summer and then plant them in the fall? Hint, 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 hint.
Yeah,
hint.
What I was going to do. I was going to pot them up in some decent compost mix and get them out in fall, if we have a fall.
Right. That's very much what I would suggest. I would get them into good-sized pots with a mixture of compost and a good soil-free mix, like a seed-starting soil or a potting soil, about 50-50, and then put them in a spot outside where they'll get morning sun but afternoon shade. Or, you know, if you're going to be around all summer, move them around. Make sure they get a good amount of sun in the morning. But once that sun, your sun gets up to around 1, 2 o'clock, get them into shade. One year I did this with just a beach umbrella. I had the plants in question out on my front patio, which is full sun all day. And it already had an umbrella in the center of the thing. So at 1 or 2 o'clock, I'd go out and open up the umbrella, and they did great.
Okay.
And then planting in the fall, especially in a precarious climate like yours, is much safer for long-term survival of the plants than planting in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Because your plants are so small, so young, they're not really developed, they don't have any resources inside them yet, and then your summer's going to come on like a bowling ball.
Yeah.
So if you protect them during that first summer, we'll double their size. They'll be much more resistant to transplant shock. And then wait to plant them in the ground until after Halloween. There's no rush.
Okay.
You want to wait until, you know, your last technical heat wave of the summer is over. And then ideally, I would try to find a spot, I don't know if you have this, where throughout their life they would get some respite from the sun at some time of day.
Okay, good.
The baby plants, I want to have morning sun. But once they're full grown, you know, just as long as it's not full sun all day.
Fantastic. And one other thing, Mike, I wanted to tell you, thanks for talking about pawpaws. We had much better success buying from a regional grower.
Right.
And we bought from a family of old hippies that has a wildflower nursery, only natives. They call themselves a Missouri Wildflowers Nursery up in Missouri someplace.
Uh-huh.
And they have a fantastic array of native stuff. And the pawpaw we got from them, as opposed to out east somewhere,
right,
have been much stronger. So Missouri Wildflowers Nursery is one source people can look up if they're in the central Midwest.
Okay, excellent. Well, thank you for that tip, and good luck with your trees. I mean, they really sound like the right plant for your place.
Well, good. And I got to tell you, Mike, we dumped some fruit and added some sugar, and we have 5 different kinds of butterflies, lace wings, ladybugs, and bees galore. They really need some support at this time of year when things haven't really started blooming yet.
Right. I did a pollinator talk at the big botanic garden just last year in Oklahoma City. And you do have a great diversity of native bees and other pollinators. And, yeah, early in the season, it's really good to have nectar sources for them.
Yeah, all these things are just all over. You can barely see the rotting fruit for the bees and the butterflies. We counted 5 different species of butterflies already.
All right. All right, well, keep up the good work with your pollinators. They need all the human help they can.
Well, thanks, Mike, for your hard work.
All right, you take care.
Okay, bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Will a spray of clay conquer the beetles of flea? Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's question.
Sure, Mike. Deb in Wagontown in Chester County, PA writes, I always have a problem with flea beetles on my eggplant. I follow your advice and grow the plants under row covers when they're young, but the beetles attack as soon as I take the row covers off for pollination. I sometimes use Piola, but would surround clay spray work better and longer to control them? Mike, you've certainly done previous questions of the week about flea beetles. Have you suggested using a clay spray on them?
You know, actually, these pests have only been mentioned in portions of 3 different previous questions of the week. We have not yet done a standalone article on the nasty little buggers.
Until today.
Yes, as the Rolling Stones once said, let the beetles beware.
Ugh, the Rolling Stones did not say that.
Hey, who was backstage with them in 75? Me or you? Anyway, flea beetles are the bane of eggplant growers. The pests are individually tiny, but their numbers are legion-esque. They hop up onto plants, like true fleas, and eat away at the leaves, causing very distinctive damage. It looks like somebody shot your poor plants repeatedly with a little miniature 12-gauge.
In the past, you've suggested that people protect their plants with floating row covers, until, as Deb notes, flowers begin to form and you have to remove the covers for pollination.
You know, and I still like that plan. If the nasty little beetles don't get anything to eat, sooner or later they're going to move on or die. So, one passive suggestion is to try to wait them out by keeping the covers on past that first run of flowers. Or when the flowers are there, you remove the covers briefly, pollinate the flowers with a little paintbrush, and quickly replace the row covers.
Deb mentions using Piola. What is that?
Why, that's when somebody pays off a DJ to play a new record. No. Piola is a Gardens Alive product, which means that we now have to note that we receive support for the show from Gardens Alive. So I try not to overly refer to their brands on the air.
But in this case, she specifically mentions 2 of their products.
And hers was, or is, the most recent email on this important topic. Anyway, Piola is mostly a horticultural oil spray with a tiny bit of pyrethrin added. Pyrethrin is a botanical insecticide derived from the flowers of a chrysanthemum. But the amount used in Piola is so low that the official EPA label even says it's safe for bees as long as you don't spray the bees directly with it.
And oil sprays in general work by smothering insects. So if you see flea beetles on the plant leaves and spray them directly with any kind of horticultural oil, it should smother and kill them.
A thought that makes gardeners smile. So yes, if prevention has failed and you're under shotgun attack, spraying a light horticultural oil, that's opposed to the heavy oils that you use during the winter dormant season, will smother any insects the spray hits without harm to the plants.
What about the surround clay spray? I know you've used it on your peach trees.
Yeah, and it probably kept them alive for twice as long as anything else would have. These sprays of micronized clay contain no insecticide of any kind. They're designed to be used early in the season, before pests begin to show up in large numbers. They coat the plant with a protective whitish-gray film that seems remarkably effective at repelling a huge number of insects.
Including the dreaded flea beetle. Officially?
Yes. I wanted to be sure of this part, so I read through the official product information sheet. And Surround is specifically EPA approved for control of flea beetles on leafy crops. And corn.
Corn? Wow, flea beetles attack corn?
Yeah, who knew, right? Anyway, we have a good plan here. Row covers followed by clay sprays. I'll add that having some finesse can help here, as clay doesn't harm bees, but a heavy layer could make it difficult for them to pollinate flocked flowers. So go slow and have a helper hold a little piece of cardboard or paper over each flower as you spray the leaves.
flocked flowers?
Yeah, it's funny. When properly applied, these clay sprays make your plants look like department store Christmas decorations. But who cares if your eggplant leaves look like Wanamaker's windows in December if it means you finally get to harvest some eggplant?
Okay, anything else?
Yeah, it's really critical that you begin the season with super healthy plants. All insect pests are attracted first to weak, spindly plants. So if you're trying to start your own plants from seed in the wrong soil without enough light, nothing's going to save them from attack. Same with using cheap chemical fertilizers to feed the plants. The super fast and super weak growth spurts these things cause are very attractive to pests. And finally, one of our more interesting previous questions of the week that mentions flea beetles was a listener's suggestion article that included instructions on how to physically protect your plants with tall plastic walls that the beetles can't jump over.
And we'll get the beetles to pay for the wall.
That's right. We're going to make our eggplant great again. Well, that sure was some great information about beaten flea beetles now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to rip my row covers if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. Please. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all those questions you were going to send us, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez-Lun is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Special thanks to Dave Heller, host of WHYY's Newsworks Tonight, for trying to show me how to do a proper interview. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website proper. Like the Beatles, our intern, Michael Inglés, likes to eat eggplant. As does Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our editor, Al Banks, heard the word Beatles and said, hey, I would have been happy with Ringo money. Welcome aboard to our answer to George Martin, production assistant Brett the Viking Raider. I'm the real fifth Beatle, Mike McGrath, but I quit the group to grow raspberries. Or did I quit the group to play backup guitar for the raspberries? Or was it Get Back? Or is it because Paul said get out? And was I the Eggman or the eggplant? Either way, I'll be back to say goo goo joo again next week. The Zika virus has people worried sick. And it seems that gardeners may be among the most at risk. I'm Mike McGrath, and we will devote the entire hour of the next You Bet Your Garden to mosquito identification and non-toxic prevention.